Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Well, hello again, everyone, and a belated Happy New Year to you all. I hope your holidays were good and that the year to come has all good things in store for you. As the saying goes, I don't know art, but I know what I like, and I really like Mark Ulrichsen's work. The California-based artist has a unique style, which has earned him awards and presentations, including gold and silver medals from the New York Society of Illustrators, and he has a work in a permanent collection of the Smithsonian and the Library of Congress. He's one of these artists where you know you've seen his stuff, but you don't know the name or the story behind the artists. So that's what we're doing here today on the bookshelf. I had the opportunity to talk to Ulrichsen recently about his work. Enjoy.
For those of us who are art illiterates like me, how would you describe your style?
I'll borrow a term that a friend gave me, another artist friend, who called it gracefully awkward. And as he said, anything with the word gracefully in it can't be too bad.
That's right.
But there is a kind of, as my kids said when they were younger, it's kind of real, kind of cartoony. So somewhere in between there. It's just based on, you know, my life and how many influences I've had and how my muscles coordinate and what have you. And, you know, it comes out the way it comes out.
Now, when doing research for this, I found a nice collection of your baseball work on the ESPN website, and I noticed there are several examples of George Steinbrenner and Barry Bonds there. Now, some comedians and impersonators like to choose certain individuals because of their unique styles and quirks. Do you feel that way about some of the people you paint?
Sure. In fact, I tend to slightly exaggerate. I don't know if it's a total caricature, but I kind of push one feature or another in a certain direction to just give it a little more emphasis. And sometimes those people who almost look like caricatures to begin with are impossible to draw. Like Larry Ellison was the hardest because he already looks like a caricature. But in the case of Steinbrenner or Barry Bonds, the reason why I portrayed them is those were probably assignments for the New Yorker. I'm a Red Sox and Giants fan, so I get a lot of assignments to do the Yankees because of the New Yorker, and I really don't like that team.
I'll get back to the New Yorker in a bit. But on your website, you're very open about your process, how you work, where you work, etc. Why did you decide to do that way?
No, it's just my nature. I'm a very open person. So, and I know that people love to know what goes into the sauce, you know, how things are made. When I go to an artist's studio, I want to see what's on their walls or where their paints are organized or how they set up their workspaces. So I think people like to have access to that, and especially in this day and age where everybody wants access to everything.
For those listening who might not have access to your website right this minute, describe your workspace.
Well, I'm in it right now. I live in a Victorian house in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury neighborhood, and I'm in an upstairs bedroom of about 150 square feet, and every square inch is covered with something. So there's a lot of visuals all over the place. I'm organized, but I keep collecting stuff. So it's a small space. I'm waiting to make some more money. Maybe your podcast will send me over the hump, and I'll be knock out the wall between my studio and one of my kids' rooms and double my space. But for now, I've been cramped in here for about 17 years, and it's starting to get a little old. But
well, I will say that on your website, there is a place where you can buy paintings and magnets.
Among other things, print, originals, note cards. Sometimes my wife makes wallets and checkbook covers. Remember checkbooks and passport holders out of my work. So we've been a mom and pop shop for a while now because my wife works for me and helping me to get this stuff out there.
Now, since you have done a lot of athletes over the years, have you ever presented an athlete with a portrait you've done of them?
Not physically, but I have sent some paintings or prints to people. And in particular, I did a painting to celebrate the Giants winning their first championship in San Francisco in 2010, and having been a lifelong San Francisco Giants fan, I thought, okay, I just got to do something to commemorate this momentous occasion. And I did a painting about the team, and prominently in it is Tim Lincecum, and less prominently but humorously is Brian Wilson, the beard on the scoreboard at Pac Bell Park. And I sent prints to both of those guys, and I heard nada in return.
Oh, that's a shame.
I don't know if they ever got it or if they got it and they're just so blasé about, you know, people loving them that they'd rather to send a courtesy thank you.
Sure, sure. That's just not right. So do you have a favorite athlete?
No. No. I mean, I like sports, and you know, you can't really know what these people are like as human beings, so I tend not to get into hero worship too much. I love the game. I love a lot of sports, in particular baseball, and I hate the economics of it, and I don't like the entitlement of certain athletes and how they live in their own little world that us mortals can't relate to other than paying exorbitant prices to get in, to park, to drink a beer, to eat a hot dog.
Now I understand your association with the Giants. How did you come to be a Red Sox fan?
Lived in Boston, went to school in Massachusetts, lived in the Cape, so Massachusetts is like my second state. And also, I think in 67 when the Az had the Triple Crown, when I was 10 years old, I really started following the Sox, and of course loved them in 75. And then they went in hard times, and when they won in 2004, it was magnificent. And then they sort of became the Yankees light with their purchases of free agents and stuff. So I'm really glad to see that they've kind of turned it around. And when they won their last championship, it was with a team that was, you know, much more enjoyable than the ones where they're just going out and getting the highest price free agents.
Now, when you do your drawings, I mean, is that even the right word for them?
Well, they are drawings initially, and then they become paintings.
Okay. When you do that, do you work from a photograph? Do you draw freestyle? How do you go about that?
I work from a series of as many photos as I can, because I don't want to just utilize this photo and, you know, here's a drawing of a photo. So it might be the head of from this one. It might be the lighting in that one. It might be the body language in another one. So I kind of make a little puzzle come together with almost everything I do.
Now, since you are so prolific, how long does it take you to do a cover for The New Yorker?
It depends on what their needs are. So there's been times when I've awakened to an email that we need a sketch, a submission of a sketch within 45 minutes or an hour, and you're meeting with other people you don't even know who they are, so you hop in the shower and see what you can come up with. And it might be due that day at 8 o'clock that night, or it might be due the next day. Or if I do a cover, and New Yorker covers are speculative work, submissions, you typically don't get an assignment. You might get a call to submit. And if I have more time, it could take anywhere from 3 days to 2 weeks, depending on how complex it is and how big I paint it. But it's a world of quick turnaround.
Do you get – I notice on your website again, you have a category of rejections from The New Yorker. So are those things that you submitted to them that they turned down, or things they asked for that they didn't quite like?
More the former. You submit ideas, and I don't know what my batting average is. Maybe it's 100, maybe it's 200 as far as how many sketches I submit before a cover gets approved. And some covers get approved, and then – the news changes or someone comes up with a better idea and then he gets bumped or it gets killed entirely. So it's always a crapshoot, but those rejected covers are ones that for one reason or another, they didn't like.
Now, do you get a lot of feedback from readers?
It varies. When I did my first New Yorker cover, it also accompanied 17 inside illustrations, a story about Hillary Clinton. And I was overwhelmed with the response, which was fantastic. And, you know, as people get used to it, it's been 20 years now I've been contributing to them. I might hear from five people. I did do a cover about Dick Cheney and George Bush that was a parody of the Brokeback Mountain cover, and it also tied into our Brokeback Mountain movie poster, and it tied into an incident where the vice president had a hunting accident and shot his buddy in the face. And that garnered a lot of response, and The New Yorker was kind enough to share some of the letters of hate from people who canceled it. But they like to get a response, and sure, I like to get the feedback. I mean, you do the work because it's like breathing. I have to do it. But on the other hand, you want to hear how people respond to it.
Of course. Now, again, on your website, you break down your work into a few categories: life, portraits, animals, and sports. Within that group, do you have a favorite?
No, but I'll be honest with you, Ron. I'm burning out on the sports stuff. I've been doing it too much, and it just hasn't really taken me to another level that I was hoping it would, like with, say, Major League Baseball or some of these franchises that I do a lot of imagery for. But I have a tendency to always paint people or dogs or some living, breathing thing. I have trouble doing a landscape or a still life. I'm very people-centric.
People and animal-centric. You seem to like dogs a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they're fun to paint, and they never complain about their likeness. And I've had dogs throughout my life, sometimes going without because I was a young adult. And now that I've got a house, we're on our second chocolate lab right now, and he's getting old. And I think we'll always have dogs in our life.
Mm-hmm. You also worked on a couple of kids' books. What was that like?
Disappointing because the publisher put a lot of time and effort into promoting the first book. Unfortunately, since it was my first children's book, I didn't do a very good job with it, and so I blame me for its lackluster response. But when the sequel came out, because it was the same author, Elizabeth Winthrop, and it was about a dog, naturally, I was much happier with the second book, but because the first book didn't sell that well, bookstores wouldn't even carry it.
Well, children's market must be especially tough because there's just so much of it out there.
Well, I go into a bookstore and you just see the reams and reams and reams of kids' books. And it's like, does the world really need another children's book? It really doesn't. But there's a lot of people in the supply chain from the publishing houses to the printers to the distributors to the book reviewers, that they got to keep churning out product. So I can understand why there's stuff out there, but also how hard it is to reach an audience. But I'm still going to hang in there. I'm about 5 years behind on my other book that I've written, my own children's book, and now I've kind of jumped the gun, and I'm about ready to go to a press with a book of my own that's based on 20 years of dog paintings.
Oh, nice. Who's publishing that?
They're called Oro Editions, and typically what they produce are photographic books of architecture, and they want to go in a new I don't know what you call it. I don't know. You might have to edit this because I can't think of what it is, Ron. But
something
else within a publishing house. Anyway,
okay.
They're going to have something called Goff Editions, and the publisher is named Gordon Goff, and so he wants to put out some books that are more about contemporary art as opposed to just photography, and so that's where I'm going with this.
Mm-hmm. Very good. We've been talking with Mark Ulrichsen, who designs many wonderful covers for the New Yorker magazine on sports and other topics. Mark, thank you for talking with us today.
Sure, Ron.
And that was our interview with Mark Ulrichsen. To find out more about his work, visit his website. That's markulriksen.com. Now, I know I've been saying this for the past few years, ever since I've started this podcast, but we're really going to make an effort. It's our New Year's resolution to come up with these podcasts on a much more regular basis. And in that regard, our next guest will be Andrew Zimbalist, the sports economist, who, with Benjamin Baumer, has just come out with a new book, The Sabermetric Revolution, Assessing the Growth of Analytics in Baseball. Andrew Zimbalist will be a guest at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse on Tuesday, January 28th at 7 p.m. For more information about that, visit bergino.com. Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. Thanks for visiting the website. For more information on a daily basis or pert near a daily basis, please visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com. So long, and see you next time.
Pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonderful game."
And that was Kevin Baker talking about his work on Reggie Jackson's latest memoir, Becoming Mr. October. Well, thanks for listening. Tune in again soon. We hope to be doing these more often. And don't forget, it's holiday time, and nothing makes a better baseball book gift than 501 Baseball Books Fans Must Read Before They Die, available at Amazon.com and hopefully your local bookstore. Thanks again, everybody. See you soon.